Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Men, when we leave the house, it's phone, wallet, keys, how's my hair look? But if you're experiencing hair loss, you may not be so confident when you step outside your door. It's time to get that confidence back and restore your hair with Hims. No man wants to lose his hair, but for men, it's actually quite common. And now with Hims, the solution is simple. Try Hims Hair Loss Solutions and you'll be joining hundreds of thousands of subscribers who got their flow back. Men, real talk. The only thing worse than losing your hair is waiting forever for it to grow back. That's why you need Hims, and you can start seeing your hair grow back in as little as 3 to 6 months. Hims provides access to a range of hair loss treatments that work, all from the comfort of your couch. Hims makes treating hair loss simple, with doctor-trusted treatment options and clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil that can regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. They offer personalized chewable, oral, spray, and serum treatment options, so you can find what works best for you. The process is simple and 100% online. Just answer a few questions and a medical provider will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your treatment is sent directly to your door. Hims has hundreds of thousands of trusted subscribers, so if you feel like you're losing a part of yourself with your hair loss, get Hims and get your confidence back. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/Hail Mary. That's HIMS.com/Hail Mary for your personalized hair loss treatment options. HIMS.com/Hail Mary. Results vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil. Prescription products require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of 5-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports Podcast. I'm Dave Zirin. So excited for this week's show, of course, brought to you by The Nation Magazine. I'm going to be talking with basketball savant Arya Shirazi, and you might be thinking to yourself, hey, you guys did an Olympic show. Hey, training camp may have just started, but the season is a little bit away. What do you guys possibly have to talk about? Well, later in the show, I'm going to be talking some serious sports and politics about Tyreek Hill and what happened in Miami. But with Arya, there is basketball stuff to suss through. And we are going to talk about the 5 players that we are intrigued by watching this season. Now, there are a couple of rules to how we decided to do this. The first is no rookies and no second-year players, because that's just obvious. Like, who isn't curious what a rookie like, say, for example, Reed Sheppard is going to do in Houston? I'm curious about Reed Sheppard. Or a second-year player, someone like Victor Wembanyama. Like, will they take the leap? Or will Scoot Henderson ever justify the hype? Those are easy ones. So we're not doing first-year or second-year players. We're doing vets in the league, minimum entering their third year, and people were intrigued by it. Now, also, I want to say the other rule is that this isn't necessarily players we expect to make some big leap. Hell, it could be players we expect to fall off the face of the earth, or it could be someone, in my case, I'm just telling you right now, who, if I'm curious if they can fill the role that's been assigned for them, because the quality of their team this year will not depend on this player becoming any sort of all-star, but just able to fill a critical role. So I'm super excited about this. We're going to get into it right now. Arya and I are going to go back and forth. First and foremost, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, man. I agree. It's a little early for a true season preview. And I actually think training camp might not begin for a couple of weeks. I don't know that people, it started.
Yes, you're right. You're right about formal training camp, but according to the podcast I listened to, people this week entered the building for informal stuff, informal workouts, talking to coaches. That was this week.
Well, nonetheless, I'm looking forward to talking a few players of intrigue for the upcoming season.
Because it is really interesting, like thinking about players, you know, they're coming off this season, they're coming off the Olympics. You know, some players may respond really well to that. It has happened before. And it's just kind of fascinating to me, like, to think about who could possibly play a big role this year or fall off or be a quality role player on a team that really needs one. So let's start with you, Shiraz. Your first intrigued person. I'm curious. By the way, we don't know who the other person picked. It'll actually be kind of interesting how aligned we are. So who's your first person, Shiraz?
Well, when you suggested this topic to me, which I thought was a great idea, you used a certain player as an example of a player to talk about. And you said, you know, we won't use this guy, but this is kind of like how you envision the discussion occurring. And the player that you used as your kind of test, I thought was a great player to talk about. After we decided to do this show, I was thinking to myself, I want to talk about that player and his role on the team. So I am actually starting with one of your ideas, which is Jimmy Butler of the Miami Heat. Mm. Jimmy clearly and on the downside of what has been an overachieving all-star career for Butler, drafted at the very end of the first round, and will get Hall of Fame consideration for the amount of winning he's done and the amount of winning with him as the primary driver of those that postseason winning that he's done throughout his career, especially with the Heat. Certainly not pegged as that kind of player at Marquette or being drafted into the league. Anyway, Jimmy famously had a super disappointing end to the season. He hurt himself in the Heat's narrow play-in loss to the Sixers last year and then missed the entire first round series, giving the Heat no chance to put any upset into the top seeded Celtics. So that's kind of where Jimmy's at. And Jimmy, this was not an anomaly. Jimmy has plays as hard as anybody, really plays all corners of the floor when he's playing. But Jimmy, even as a younger player, was a sure bet to miss some regular season games, and that has only intensified as he's as he's become an older player. So the reason that I thought Butler, once you mentioned his name, was a really interesting player to talk about for the upcoming season is the question is, how much can Jimmy give? Because looking at Miami, I think that they do not need him to shoulder the offensive load. Actually, when I look at that team, if they're trotting out their healthy preferred lineup, I see Jimmy as the fourth option, actually, which is a great, a very fortunate position for a team to be in, and a great role for Butler at this point at his advanced NBA stage and with his injury history. I mean, I see Tyler Herro, Bam Adebayo, and Terry Rozier as being more go-to scorers than Butler. And if those four guys can stay on the floor for the majority of the season, and really all but Adebayo have suffered, you know, missed considerable time last year. So I don't know if that quartet ever saw the floor together, actually, for Spoelstra last year. And if they did, it was a minuscule sample size. But again, those four players healthy, I think that puts them right as a top four team in the East. And with a pretty strong rotation outside of those guys. But again, I'm thinking if Butler can put in 65 games, and that is certainly not a given, and because he won't need to be the primary scorer, or at times even a primary scorer in a win, him being able to fill that role that he has always filled, but possibly putting even more of a energy towards defense and the floor game with those other three guys capable of putting in 20 nightly, I think Butler's availability is going to be possibly the key factor, as I said, in Miami being a serious contender in the East.
Good stuff. The only thing I'll add to that, which adds some intrigue to what you said, is that this is a contract year for Butler. He expected to get that done in the offseason. They did not, with Pat Riley being pretty clear that, you know, they weren't sure if they were going to move off of him or not. You know, Riley's pretty ruthless when it comes to stuff like this. He's like, okay, you're done, you're done. And with Butler, the age he is at and the injury history that you mentioned comes with Butler being very public about the fact, and I wonder if this messes with what you're saying at all, that he's ready to be number one option Jimmy Butler again and prove himself with this contract. That doesn't sound like somebody willing to accept a role. Obviously, these things have a way of working themselves out, and they have one of the best coaches, so that could very easily work itself out, and Butler will accept a role. It's frankly where I totally agree with you. It doesn't really matter to me for the Heat's success, whether he's fourth, third, second, or first option. What matters to me is the number one ability of all, availability. If he's available for 65 games, it will be very intriguing to watch him this year to see whether in his mid-30s he can have a bit of a renaissance. So props to you. That was a great start. My first guy that I'm very intrigued to see how he does this year is, you know you and I are partial to following the Knicks very closely. How can I not be intrigued by Julius Randle and what he's going to mean to the Knicks this year? Very briefly, Julius Randle, I feel, has somehow, was one of those guys who got so overrated for a while, he's now underrated. Like, the fans in New York are very tough on him because he's weak in the playoffs. There's a criticism of him that he pounds the ball too much, which doesn't unlock Jalen Brunson the way it needs to. But people forget, you know, this is a two-time All-NBA player. He was an All-Star last year. I mean, seriously, like, you look at his stats, like 25, 10, and 6. And when you look at Brunson's absence of a secondary creator in the playoffs, I mean, that's really why they were up 3-1 to Indiana and then blew it, is like, how much could Brunson possibly do? I mean, at some point, the whole operation just ran out of gas, other players getting injured, the whole thing, overplaying Ananobi. I mean, all of these places is where Julius Randle could really help a lot. And he's a better passer than people give him credit for. But if the Knicks struggle, who do you think is going to get blamed first? It's not going to be Thibodeau. It's not going to be Miles Bridges. It sure wouldn't, as hell, wouldn't be St. Brunson. People are going to go after Randle, no matter how good his play, because they will say stylistically, he just doesn't mesh. And the other reason is that it really was only after Randle got hurt last year that the whole Nova Knicks thing really took off, because Josh Hart had more playing time, DiVincenzo played more, and Brunson had to be this all-world player for the rest of the year. Now they're going all in with the Nova Knicks, trading a ton for Miles Bridges. So where does Randle fit into this conception of the club is very intriguing to me. And will he be able to mesh with this new creation that he really didn't have much of a part of that we now call the Nova Knicks?
The Knicks really could have used Randle in the playoffs last year, and that became readily apparent because they made a pretty unlikely and incredibly inspiring run to the number two seed. I mean, they had a great stretch run on the back of Brunson, who, as we've discussed in the past, took his game to all world levels. He was a first team All-NBA player after the All-Star break and really propelled the Knicks to going into the playoffs with tremendous momentum, where it continued until it stalled out kind of devastatingly. And that was really a manpower thing. And guys who had stepped up into featured roles that they hadn't ever had to play before and were delivering, finally that caught up to them, and having to do that for 46 minutes a game in high intensity playoff games caught up to them. So it makes sense that Randle would be a question mark. Randle to me is the perfect ingredient. It's Mikal Bridges who's been added.
Did I say Miles Bridges?
Yes. And
very different people. I make that mistake a lot, actually. But you know, it's one of those things where that's not like a happy mistake. That's like, you know, Mikal Bridges sends a cease and desist letter to me and says, right, never compare me to Miles Bridges again.
Yeah, it's like being confused with Alvin Robertson.
People can feel that. Go ahead.
So then, you know, acquiring Bridges signals that the Knicks want to go even further, want to build on what they've created, which is, of course, how they should be feeling. Julius Randle, as you've said, has put up all-star seasons with huge numbers as the number one option on teams that have won. They haven't been empty stats. He's done winning with the Knicks, who then continued to win in his absence. Putting that together should make the situation only better. And it is not adding an unknown. Randle and Brunson and this, you know, have played together for a few seasons now, have played well, playing off of one another. And Randle, as you illustrated, is not a black hole. He's a surprisingly willing passer for a front court scorer. So I don't consider the Knicks a truly up-tempo run-and-gun team. I really don't. I think they're opportunistic. So inserting or reinserting Randle back into the offense now is the number two option, rather than number one, which is more appropriate for his skills. So that should make the team even better. Mikal Bridges is a much better number three scorer than number two scorer. And Anunoby is a more effective number four scorer than number three. I think that they should work that Randall in a way should be reintegrated seamlessly. As you had said, you know, once the Knicks faced Indiana, even taking a 3-1 lead, their offense was not looking good. I mean, Brunson was so exhausted, and he was their only shot creator anyway. And exactly. He was not creating those looks for others like he had been in the round prior, and his shots weren't going down like they had been. He had tired legs, totally justifiable. So you add not only a complimentary piece, but again, somebody who has been a go-to scorer in this league with a couple of different teams. To me, I would be surprised if Randall winds up being looked at as a negative or the situation deteriorates to the point where he has to be scapegoated. I'm expecting this to be a good season for the Knicks.
Oh, I am too. Before I throw you the next one, just like Jimmy Butler, Randall's another contract guy too. So it'll be very interesting. I always find it interesting how
always a factor.
Just is.
Yeah.
It just is. You know, you want that next contract. You put in that extra work. All right, who's your next?
Okay. I am going with a third-year player, so a young veteran, Christian Braun of the Nuggets.
One of mine.
Oh, okay, nice. Or is it Brown? It looks like it's
Brown.
It should be spelled like it should be pronounced Braun. Indeed. But I think that Christian Braun, and since this was one of yours, we can discuss freely as always. The Nuggets' lack of depth was really exposed last year. 2 years ago, when Denver won the title, they had just about a perfect roster construction. It really was around the player to have, around like the franchise player of franchise players. It was the perfect construction right here. Whether you consider Jamal Murray a true star or not, that starting lineup was absolutely perfect around Jokic, and Malone had a 9-man rotation, and everybody really played their clear complementary roles perfectly. They lost a few of those rotation pieces after that season, didn't seem to adequately replace them. So Brown, even last year, was being looked at as a player that the team was looking to make a big jump into his second season, and was kind of talked about, I think, as a bit of a dark horse sixth man candidate, because since Denver's bench was looking increasingly thin, he was expected to play a very key role. And he didn't make that jump. He had his moments. He did not make that jump that the team was hoping and expecting. And Denver's bench, as predicted, turned out to be a weakness. And they didn't return to the championship round. This year, they lost their backup point guard, who had been, Reggie Jackson, had played key minutes when Murray had been missing games throughout the season, as he always misses some games. And even much more crucially, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, their starting shooting guard for the past couple of years, who plays a vital role on both ends of the floor, left in free agency. And unless you consider Russell Westbrook still a starting caliber guard in the NBA, I feel as though those days have certainly passed for Russ. The Nuggets bench, it looks even worse than it did last year, with Brown now going into that starting two role by necessity. If you watch Christian Brown play, he looks more than up to it. He is, you know, he looks like you're like the starting shooting guard you would want to build. The height, the frame, explosive athleticism, along with Aaron Gordon, he's really the Nuggets' only true explosive athletes. And I think the reason that that Braun looks good, you know, quarter by quarter or within a quarter, is because he gets a lot of flashy points with that athleticism. You know, he'll get tip dunks, and he finishes strong on the fast break, and also has a very sweet stroke. You know, and when it goes down, it looks great. But he's had trouble having that shot go down on a consistent basis, which again was why he didn't make the leap last year. And this year, it can't just be a hope. If Brown doesn't make a tremendous leap into starting NBA guard play, I don't see the Nuggets with a top four finish in the West, even if he does make a big jump into a consistent double figure score. I don't think he's going to replace Pope's defense on any level. But if he does not make a tangible offensive leap, I think Denver is truly going to suffer and is going to get passed by a lot of teams in the West that have addressed voids.
Well, Denver has the greatest player on earth in Nikola Jokic, 3 championships in 4 years, but
3 MVPs. Sorry.
Jeez, I'm being sloppy today. Miles Bridges is going to come to my house. No, let me just go away from that.
You don't want that.
I don't want that. I'd rather have Mikal Bridges come over for some tea and crumpets. So, 3 MVPs in 4 years. Nikola Jokic, so amazing. But he's also going to be partnering with Jamal Murray, who's coming off an awful Olympics in Canada and had a really awful playoffs. Even though he had a couple of game-winning shots, his shooting splits are just horrible in the playoffs. And it's going to be a really challenging year. You know, KCP – so let's talk about Christian Braun. I'll give my 2 cents and then we'll move on. I don't need to say much because you said a lot of my stuff, which was great. The couple of things I would throw in is, you know, the KCP got a nickname after the Lakers discarded him as part of the horrific Russell Westbrook trade to my Washington Wizards. The KCP started to be known less as Kentavious Caldwell Pope than people calling him Keep Championship Players. Like, he is a great wing guy for a championship team. Doesn't need the ball, hits the three, plays hellacious defense, extremely smart. He's a championship player. And when he had to play a bigger role than that in Washington, it was kind of yikes. And similarly, I think in Orlando, I mean, people are so psyched to have KCP in Orlando. Again, kind of yikes. That's not what Orlando needs. He's a championship player. He belongs on a first-tier team that he can help. And I don't know, them not re-signing him, I think it was cheap. I think it was short-sighted. And Christian Braun has big shoes to fill because, well, this is my thing with Braun, is that what they need from that position is a shooter. They need a shooter. It's the way the whole team is freaking constructed. You know, and Russ, if Russell Westbrook does anything for them, he's going to be a version of Aaron Gordon, you know, running the baseline, taking passes from Jokic, finishing at the rim. I learned the other day that Russ is actually the worst three-point shooter in NBA history for a number of attempts.
Worse than Charles Barkley?
Yeah, it's crazy. Wow. It's crazy. I mean, we're living in an era where people, you know, Magic Johnson had 1 year where he went 1-for-21 from three, and that was his whole season. You know, it's like it wasn't a shot people even practiced, really. And here we are in this era of the three, and Russ can't put it down. He's not terrible from the corners, but everywhere else on the court, just a disaster. So that's who Christian.
So why was he so hurt when people called him Westbrook?
Because he's a very sensitive.
What are they supposed to call him?
I think Westbrook is freaking hilarious as a nickname for him, but because it's so true. But, you know, he's also an all-time great, and he's a sensitive soul. So, and I loved him in Washington. So it's hard for me to even talk down on him because he was so much fun his 1 year in D.C. So I feel like, you know, sense of kinship, if you will. And I wish he'd stayed on the Wizards and just gotten massive empty stats for a shitty team. That would have been a lot of fun. The only other thing I'll say about Christian Brown is that, you know, they're ready to hand the keys to him for this position. The one thing that also might be lurking a little bit is they have a 6'8" guy entering his third year named Peyton Watson, who is a hell of an athlete, but considered to be very raw. You know, if Brown is a bust, they might just say, let's try this 6'8" guy and see if he can do it. But either way, they need someone who can shoot from those corners or they won't be unlocking what's special about Jokic. So there you go. I mean, you're right. If Brown doesn't step up, I could see the Nuggets being in the second tier in the West instead of the first where they should be.
As you just said, that is a bit of an indictment on Denver's general management, because Jokic is still that guy. He is still the player to have. He is his, you know, reigning MVP. So, and could easily be four-time defending. So, the window is absolutely right now. And if it is realistic for that team to say, to shrug and say, let's plug in this 6'8" guy, maybe he'll be better than that guy in your starting lineup, then in a way you've let down the true potential that your team should have right now.
Yeah. And, you know, they didn't add anybody. And you said it right. Like their bench was very thin last year. And so what are their big differences between last year and this year?
Only got worse.
Yeah, a much more suspect shooting guard and a point in Jamal Murray, who's coming off a disastrous offseason and has talked about being injured. He has a history of injuries. And it's just like you have just look at what Philly has done for Embiid, you know, in terms of adding pieces with Paul George. And I think a tremendous bench, like with a little bit money, I think Philly did really well. Or you look at the way that Dallas has put together a team around Luka, and they're subtracting in Denver, not adding, subtracting. It's just kind of maddening. Okay, since I was just doing Brown based on your Brown, you're actually next, sir.
All right. Talked about a veteran towards the end of his career, talked about still a very young player looking to take on a bigger role. So now I've got somebody on my mind who's smack in the middle of his career, or at least should be still in his prime, but not sure that he is, which is why he's kind of an intriguing player to me. And that is Marcus Smart of the Grizzlies.
Ooh, an intriguing team. And an intriguing player. Please go ahead.
For sure. No, I mean, we have Smart stock partially through no fault of his own, has really kind of low key plummeted in the last year because as you had said, actually, as you had kind of detailed when you and I gave our season wrap up last year and had to eat crow. New England crow about how the Celtics trading Smart had been rightly, if not criticized, questioned. And the conversation about him as being reheaded core. And obviously, Smart was somewhat of an effectively unique player who had played a big role in Celtics teams that had won a lot of games. So trading him was not without questions. And those questions, I feel like his absence was almost immediately forgotten. Boston being the wall-to-wall best team in the league, culminating in their championship, Smart was not a part of the conversation anymore. And that was coupled with who he had been traded to, I thought was in a way the perfect destination for him. He was traded to a Memphis team that knew they were losing Ja Morant for the first 25 games of the season on suspension. And as far as having to replace your franchise player, and really the player who's largely responsible for your recent success, Smart seemed like a good option because he could plug in at point guard. He was slash is one of the very best individual defenders, man up defenders in the league. So he instantly was going to add that element to a Memphis team that already liked to play physical hard nose defense, prided themselves on that. And then he seemed to be a very workable backcourt mate when Morant did return. And the thinking in Memphis was, hopefully we can hold it down enough, play close enough to 500 ball, that when Ja comes back, we can play, we can accelerate and be back in the playoff conversation. The lost season pretty much from game one, and Smart missed the majority of the season with the assorted injuries. And when he did play, he was not a big difference maker and was certainly not any kind of a replacement for Morant. So that whole history led to, all right, Ja is back now and seemingly healthy. Desmond Bain also missed a large portion of that lost season. So now, is a three perimeter rotation, starting rotation of Morant, Bain, and Smart, with each of them seemingly bringing very, very kind of diverse skills, which all on paper should work together, along with Jaren Jackson up front, who is pretty much their only important player who was healthy last year and was forced to take on a much bigger role on offense that really he's suited to. Now that he's got those scores back, he should be relied on to score less, which is a better role for him. But after a one-year lost season, can Marcus Smart return to being that player he was in Boston and be an essential ingredient for Memphis to return to being a team hoping to win a playoff round in the West?
Mm, good stuff. Memphis might be my most intriguing team because last year might have been a lost season, but they did develop some players who are now on their bench. And they drafted Zach Edey to take the place of Steven Adams. Zach Edey's like 7'5", and Zach Edey, who had a great summer league, is actually the favorite in Vegas to win Rookie of the Year this year. They just think he's going to have a lot of opportunities playing with Ja. And it's going to be exciting to see this team. They have a great coach, and you know, Ja, I mean, is one of the most entertaining players in the game. Like, to me, he's must-see TV, so that'll be really exciting. My next person is actually, oh, sorry, go ahead.
I just wanted to say just one more thing, which is Memphis being no factor without Morant from the start I think really showed that Ja's not only one of the most exciting on-court players, but really showed his value and showed his kind of almost like, you know, fringes of the MVP conversation play. Memphis had won upwards of 50 games and I think had been the two seed back-to-back seasons. And this proved that that was largely on the back of Morant, or at least on the ability of the other players to play off of that singular entity that really the entirety of the opposing team's defense has to be reacting to.
Yeah, last year, Bane had to do more when he played. He wasn't as effective. Triple J, Jaren Jackson Jr., had to be a number one scoring option for a long time. It didn't go well. So, no, you're absolutely right. There's a narrative that could develop, a Ja MVP narrative. I mean, that would be amazing to see because I love watching this team. And, yeah, he made some off-the-court mistakes, but it's not like he's Miles Bridges or anything, or Mikal Bridges, for that matter. Or Lloyd Bridges. All right. So my next is like a double duo. First of all, Shirazi, do you remember who I picked coming out of the West at the start of the 2023-24 season?
Coming out of the West.
Start of the
Phoenix.
Year,
Phoenix.
Very good, sir. God, your memory never ceases to amaze. I picked the Phoenix Suns. I was all in. I'm a Bradley Beal guy, Kevin Durant, Devin Booker.
I think I remember that, you know, because I'm so familiar with your Love 8 fixation with Bradley Beal. So,
yeah, he's the player that I'm the least dispassionate about in the NBA. My feelings for him always run hot, whether in positive or negative reasons. And last year they ran very negative. But the big thing last year, if you remember going into the season, they give up Chris Paul for Beal. And the idea was like, well, they can do what they call point Booker, Devin Booker, or point Beal, you know, point guard by committee if they need to. And all of this stuff that was just horrible up and down the line. The team under Frank Vogel actually played decent defense, which nobody suspected. Vogel's a great defensive coach. They were like 10th, 11th in offense, a lot of turnovers, Beal injured most of the year, and then they lose badly in the first round to the T-Wolves. And of course, I picked the Suns in that series just to be consistent with my pick, even though I knew that that was just a stupid pick. So they don't have a lot of money because they're paying these three guys a fortune. So with very, very little money on the books, they get two guys, Tyus Jones and Monte Morris, to play point guard this year. Now, what is that? I saw Tyus Jones a lot, and Monte Morris played for the Wizards too 2 years ago. So I saw a lot of them over the last couple years. Did you know that Tyus Jones and Monte Morris are numbers 1 and 2 all time in NBA history in assist to turnover ratio? Just pretty crazy. 1 and 2 all time in assist to turnover ratio. And for a team that suffered from turnovers and suffered from having a point guard who could just set up a damn offense, I think this could be a very, very fascinating addition. So check out your lineup. You got your big three. If everybody's healthy, and I know that's a huge if, but if you got your big three, you've got Tyus Jones, and then you've got like a serviceable center, like a Nurkic, and backed up by a Mason Plumlee. That's what they're looking at, which is actually an upgrade from, I think his name was Drew Eubanks, was their backup, Bob Eubanks, former host of the Newlywed Game. But this could be something. I'm not picking the Suns to come out of the West, but this could, with Mike Budenholzer as the new coach, don't be surprised if they're a top four team this year in the West. I really am intrigued by what having these serviceable but extremely careful and professional point guards, what it does to unlock this team.
As with most things in life, the last taste we have of something is the memory that usually persists until a new memory can kind of take its place. You know, if a song ends really, really strong, then I'm always like, oh, what a great song. I always forget what a great song that was. Even if really it's been average until the very end. If it goes out strong, that's kind of the last thing that you remember. So the Suns, again, being so thoroughly dominated in the first round of the playoffs, makes the and then Frank Vogel being canned, replaced by what I consider an upgrade for sure in Budenholzer. Phoenix, it was looked at as a bad season. And actually, it was not. The Suns won over 50 games with their big three not playing together as much as playing together. I must have a higher opinion of Nurkic than you do. I consider him more than serviceable. I think he's an above average center and the perfect man in the middle for how this team is constructed and how they play. So I think actually having Nurkic in the middle is a huge plus for what Phoenix wants to do. And I think he had a good year last year. The Suns started their five best players last year. And it wasn't a good mix. So that's why I think this is like the acquisition of it's Tyus Jones, and to a lesser extent, Monte Morris, also apparently extremely careful with the ball, extremely responsible. The interesting thing is that you're going to be, if you start one of them as kind of the remedy to not having a true point guard is to bring in the truest of point guards, then who goes to the bench? I think the natural instinct is Grayson Allen.
Yes.
Allen goes to the bench.
Which is
Allen,
great.
Who also had a terrific year last year.
Actually, a great role for Allen as a sixth man, I think.
To me, Phoenix will maximize their roster, which potentially, and by what is the Suns ceiling? The NBA Finals. I don't think it's going to happen. I'll reserve my judgment until next month. But, I mean, Phoenix, you've got Durant, you've got Booker. To me, there's no reason to write Phoenix off. I think I might like the Sun going into the season. I think I might like the Suns more than the Nuggets. So I don't look at this Phoenix as this Suns team as a failed experiment yet. What I am struggling to drive at is I think their best version is Beal as the sixth man, which he wouldn't go for. With scorers like Durant and Booker are good enough scorers, possibly two of the top 10 scorers in the league, depending on how you feel about Booker. If not 10, then probably 15. But, you know, two alpha scorers, which who, as they're getting their points, that means Beal is standing around.
And there was a lot of that last year when the few moments the three played together, even Durant at times was a spot-up shooter from the corner, and that's, you know, that's like using a Ferrari to go to the grocery store.
It makes a lot more sense to have Grayson Allen and Tyus Jones standing around ready to catch and drain a jumper with 2 seconds left on the clock after defenses have collapsed on Durant and Booker than Beal. And it also, Durant, Booker, Nurkic, and Allen all had really good years last year. Beal did not. He was the least available, and he did not look like what had made Beal such a good player, great player in Washington. So if anything didn't work the way Phoenix hoped, and with a first-round playoff exit sweep, certainly didn't work the way they were hoped, Beal was the most likely. He was the one that didn't really fit in. He was the one who his acquisition certainly didn't live up to the ceiling of what that could have been. So again, will Tyus Jones and Monte, can they remedy that? Are they good enough? Will they be entrusted enough to really be the caretakers on offense to make sure that those three mega scorers are getting their touches and getting their touches in some kind of a winnable flow? Because Grayson Allen, again, to me, seems like the perfect guy to play off of those two guys and be able to either bail out possessions or get wide open looks off of double teams. I think he might be the best 3-point shooter in the league.
Yeah.
And Beal at this point is very suited to a sixth man, undisputably first option off the bench guy. If it is his night, play him the fourth quarter and go to him down the stretch. And if it is not, you are not relying on him like that. Okay. And when he inevitably misses games, it doesn't put you in scramble mode as much because his role has been carved so as not to have to be worked into what was far from a seamless fit. So I think those point guard acquisitions are good ones. I don't know if they're going to be the game changers that Phoenix wants them to be. They might.
Well, speaking of scramble mode, first of all, if it's not obvious already, I of course, very much disagree with what you said. Grayson Allen, sixth man. I still like Beal and them figuring it out. I could be extremely wrong. Like you make a very compelling case. I think a Jones-Grayson backcourt, it just feels a little slight to me. Although Grayson is a better defender than anybody thought he would be coming out of college, I got to say.
And a better defender than any of those other guys he's playing in the other guys in Phoenix's backcourt.
Beal?
Allen. Allen plays a crucial defensive role that allowing Booker and Beal to not work as hard on defense. Tyus Jones helps a lot on offense. He does not help. Adding Jones and subtracting Allen makes you a much worse defensive team, and that was already a problem area for Phoenix.
Indubitably, and they're also troubled by they have a high first round draft pick who's a great defender and a wing named Josh Okogie who just can't freaking shoot, and he actually has shown signs that he knows how to shoot. You know, it feels very psychological, and it's a damn shame because he would be a perfect fit in size and defensive ability. All right, we each have two more, and speaking of scramble mode, we got to hit these a little quick. So who's your next one?
Okay. My next one, and we don't have to speak forever about this. I'm going back to the veteran pool. And this is just about the vettiest of all of them. I'm wondering, will Chris Paul ever be able to play a truly meaningful game in San Antonio?
Game or season?
I mean, game one is meaningful, but I mean.
Oh, I got you. Okay. Down the stretch.
I like the acquisition. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing not to like about adding Paul to this Spurs team, especially built around this player at this point in his life and career. And San Antonio has made some roster improvements that I think will boost their win total. With training camp not even fully broken yet, I don't really see a way that San Antonio can be a top 10 team in the West. And the question, of course, he's entering his 20th season, a player I absolutely love, has had one of the all-time historic careers, and he's still a real NBA guard when he can play. But this isn't even the Chris Paul of 2 or 3 years ago. So my question, again, the reason that I chose to mention Chris is just saying, is it just too late in his career and slightly too early in Victor's for them to, as I said, really be, you know, have a meaningful shot at playing meaningful games down the stretch?
Good stuff. Good stuff. I love that pick. The only thing I'll say to it is Chris Paul of even 3 years ago would be so perfect for unlocking Wemby and all of Wemby's potential. 3 years ago. You know,
absolutely.
And so I have a feeling my prediction for this year with the Spurs, I think they're going to do maybe a little bit better than people think. I think their over-under in Vegas is like 35 wins, which would be a huge upgrade from, I think this last year they won either 19 or 21. I can't remember. But I don't know, man. Chris Paul would be perfect. Like, I think we're going to get like almost like weird windows or vibrations or a breeze where you feel Chris Paul's impact. And then it dissipates as quickly as it was there. So we'll see some cool shit, but Paul will get hurt. Paul will go through a long stretch playing less than 20 minutes a night. There's just going to be a lot of fuck up. And Tyus Jones is, shown himself to be a very good backup point. Not Tyus Jones.
Trey
Jones. Very serviceable backup point guard, but you don't want Trey Jones playing more minutes than Chris Paul, but I bet you that's what happens this year. All right,
this version of Chris Paul, in a way, is kind of like present-day Trey Jones.
Yeah.
Ouch. So, you know, there's no question that Chris is going to not only help Wemby, but Spurs culture, Popovich, and all of the Spurs young players, you know, by spending the season with them. But, you know, I'd love for them to be able to do more on the floor, you know, in his, you know, at truly the very end of his career.
Yeah, a very important addendum to this that I'll just throw in case people are wondering about this angle on it is Chris Paul, of course, injury plagued last year with Golden State. People wondered how he'd fit in Golden State with Steph and Clay and Podziemski. Paul was injured a lot, but when he played, he was really good. Like, he figured out a way to fit in or the second unit. He shot well. So Paul's still got juice left. He just has to stay healthy, which is cool. I like that it's not going to be a like Willie Mays circling under a fly ball wearing a Mets uniform. Like, you know, we're going to see good play from Paul. The question is just how much. All right. My next person is the most frustrating player in the NBA to me. That is a German out of Orlando named Franz Wagner. Let me explain why for a second. They have built this team Orlando Magic around their forwards, which is really rare these days. They have Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner initiating the offense from up top while everybody else sort of surrounds them and flashes in and out and the like. Banchero is somebody who I actually think is overrated. Like, he's an all-star. He, people talk about him as maybe like a next big thing and all the rest of it. I see like super inefficient shooting numbers and a limit on who he's going to be. Now, he could be an all-star several more times, but the idea of Paolo Banchero being your primary creator, I don't see that being a team that contends for an Eastern Conference title. Now, Franz Wagner, at his best, I can see being the best player on a team that competes for our finals. He's a much better creator than Banchero. He is so smooth out there on the court. He looks like he's in control of everything. He can move the game at his own speed. He's fascinating to watch, except for one little thing. Dude forgot to shoot last year. Forgot how. Shot like 28% from three. I mean, it was horrible. And it was so frustrating because Franz Wagner leads the world, in my mind, of making great moves, getting space, and then just missing the shot. And it's so annoying to see somebody that skilled not put down the shot, especially since he's shown in his career that he can hit the damn shot and has a beautiful motion and he gets arc and spin and it's so nice and it doesn't fall. So look, they signed him to a max contract in the offseason. A lot of people were like, are you sure you want to give that much money to this guy given his proclivity for bricks? And the answer to that is, yeah, you take the chance on him, absolutely, because he's that talented. But you also hope that giving him that money and giving him that kind of leadership role and belief will also unlock whatever's going on psychologically in his brain. And he'll, you know, be the player that I think he can be, which is a multiple-time all-star, all-NBA player.
I agree with just about everything you said on that. I have very little to add. I think Orlando, which legitimately broke through last season, I think that they benefited from a couple of better teams in the East having issues. And they were either they were feeling themselves more or everybody were feeling them because of that a little more than their talent or their on-court play dictated. And so I really agree with you. I think that it is a really good forward combo, not a championship one necessarily, even though they're both very, very young at the beginning of what will hopefully be long careers. I totally agree that if either one of them is capable of taking their game to truly franchise level, it's Franz. Mm-hmm. And I agree. I mean, you know, it's like Franz looks as good as anybody missing a shot, you know, just like, you know, moves like a ball player should, and he's 6'10", you know, incredible ball skills, looks like he does everything well. I think, and I'm not trying to give too much of a spoiler on this, I think Orlando is going to take a step back in the East this year if the other teams are, you know, either benefit from better health than they had or have are successfully able to address their shortcomings of last year. I can see Orlando finishing seventh or eighth this year and be having to play in as opposed to being firmly where they were last year. I think the other teams, which already might have had better talent, are looking like more complete teams in Orlando. The asterisk to that is if Franz takes his game up considerably and has almost like a Ja Morant style impact on a game throughout a season. I know that that's holding him to lofty standards, but the kind of player who, by virtue of him being the focal point, defenses have to adjust accordingly, and every other player then is able to enhance his game. Wagner's certainly not that kind of player yet. If he does become that kind of player, Orlando will benefit from.
Amen on that. I think, and you know, in Banchero, I'll just say, like, it never looks easy for Banchero. Like, he's a great leaper. He's really strong, but it never looks easy. Like, the fluidity of Franz's game is what, to me, makes him so watchable. And it'll be awesome.
Paolo seems to rattle in a lot of threes.
All right, next one, sir.
My last one, and this is kind of cheating because it's a twofer, is back to back overall number one picks from the Philadelphia 76ers in what now seems like yesteryear, but really is not so yester. And that is Ben Simmons and Markelle Fultz.
Does Markelle even have a team right now? I don't think he has a team.
Markelle is currently unsigned. I've seen him connected to Boston, which would be a drag. I've seen him even more recently connected to Oklahoma City, which would be a very good move for the Thunder. But again, I think would signal the swift either decline or never wasness of Fultz. Markelle was the number one pick in the 2017 draft. Simmons, the number one pick the year before. And if neither one of those guys plays a single NBA game this year, then I don't think that that would register as more of a blip on the ultimate NBA landscape. And that is somewhat, that's sad to me because both of those guys are well under 30. In Simmons' case, it's one of the most rapid plummets that I've ever seen in a player. Always a very unique player, an incredibly idiosyncratic player, a true all-star, almost from the moment he stepped in with the ball in his hands on a team hoping to win the East, who could never shoot. And that was widely publicized, and that was a topic almost any time somebody thought of Simmons, and was still very, very effective. So Fultz, you know, was looked at as the top prospect, the most upside in that draft. It was not boneheaded that Philly selected him, and like most or all lottery picks in the process era and post-process era, he was snake bit from the start. It seemed to be psychological as much as physical. He couldn't shoot. He couldn't shoot free throws. He couldn't stay on the court. Sixers gave up on him, went to Orlando. When he played, he looked very effective and actually looked like, for a brief time, like he was going to be the point guard on what was an emerging Orlando team. And then last year, when they truly made their breakthrough, he was injured, not a part of it, and was no longer looked at as their core, as part of their core. It looked like they were actually playing their best ball without him or without playing a featured role. And as you said, deep into the free agent, I mean, beyond that, where training camps are breaking, Fultz is still unsigned. And it looks like any landing spot, at least for this year, he's going to be a very, very limited minutes complementary player rather than being looked at as a piece of a team looking to improve and really build something. His age and at times his game indicates that he should be that kind of player. But my question, I'm interested in getting your opinion on these two guys, is will Ben Simmons and Markelle Fultz, again, still young players, even by basketball standards, although it doesn't feel that way with the saga that has been both of their careers, do you think either one of them can be an impact player this year or can ever be an impact player in the league again?
No, I think they're both cooked. I really do. And it's a damn shame because here's the reality to me is like Fultz has gotten to play a good role on a couple of teams since his early Steve Blass disease or Chuck Knoblauch disease with his shot. And it still is not at the level, obviously, where you're seeking him out to be on your team. Simmons, if he wanted to, could average, I feel like he could roll out of bed and average 17, 9, and 8. You know, it's like the physical tools have never been a question. I just think the dude has just like no heart. He, you know, his father was a pro player, and he reminds me of all those kids we knew growing up who were told they should play basketball because of their height or skills. We knew people like that. They were told to do it. They were pressured to do it, and they were good at it, but they had no heart for it. And I just see that in Simmons. And I don't want to stereotype and say you always see that in second year players, because obviously you don't. There are a lot of second year, I mean second generation players. You know, there are a lot of second generation players who have a ton of heart. I mean, this Scottie Pippen Jr. looks like a really good player as a guard. I mean, you know, he works his ass off, but this ain't it. So no, I think they're both done. They're both in the rearview mirror of the NBA, which is a damn shame, especially about Fultz. Simmons, I don't care. Okay. My last one. And this one is so obvious, it's stupid. But what can I say? I'm a big fan and I'm curious, is Damian Lillard. Because I'm a huge Lillard fan. And it's pretty rare that someone goes to a new team in a new city, makes the All-Star team, averages 25 plus a game, and people say the season was a total bust. And I get why they said it was a bust. I mean, they fucking fired their coach, Adrian Griffin, after 44 games, 45 games, and like a 33-12 record. They hired Doc Rivers, which is always like saying, abandon all hope, ye who enter here. You got Damian Lillard, you know, he thought he was going to Miami, so he's having to adjust to playing for someone else's team with Giannis. In other words, he better fit around Giannis or, you know, forget about it. It ain't going to work because Giannis is so central to unlocking what they do. And I get it. You know, even scoring 25 a game, making an all-star team, it just didn't look like you thought it was going to look with the great Dame Lillard. Now, a factor in this is he's older than you think he is because he played 4 years of college. So unlike a lot of players of his generation, he is somebody who has been around the block a few times. I mean, I think he did 4 years at Weber State. I don't think he even did three.
How old is Dame?
What's that?
How old is he now? How old is Dame now?
Well, it's funny you ask because I have that answer. He's 34. 34. Steph is 36. So he's borderline of, is the tank empty or does this guy, is he a role player now or is he still like the incredible top 75 player that we came to know in Portland? So I'm intrigued by that. I think he needs to assert more because he's a better offensive player than Giannis. Giannis may be one of the top, in my opinion, three players in the game. And Giannis is so brilliant, and I'm a big fan. But Lillard is a galactically, at his best, is a galactic offensive player. And so, or at least he was in Portland. So does he still have that in him? I'm curious. Can the Bucks make it work? I'm curious. Because the Bucks are one of those teams, Shiraz, where if this season does not go well, they might have to do some serious scrap. I mean, they're not going to re-sign Brooke Lopez if the season doesn't go well. Their bench is a mess. It's going to be very interesting to see what they do to keep Giannis happy and, frankly, just keep him in Milwaukee. You know, Chris Middleton injured as hell, but still, if you saw, I don't know if you even saw it because no one really watched this series. It was one of those NBA TV series, but Chris Middleton balled the hell out in the first round against Indiana, reminded you that, no, this was the go-to guy on a championship team because he was the go-to guy when they needed a bucket in that playoff run. So I don't know, man. Like, I'm intrigued by the Bucks. I'm intrigued by how Lillard does. I'm intrigued what else he has in the tank. So that's my number five is Dame Lillard.
I hope that Lillard still has a considerable amount left. He's a player that I've always really been a huge fan of since he entered the league. And he did not look finished. He didn't look finished to me. When when the Bucks canned Adrian Griffin, I was really, really critical of the move, not only because they were bringing in Rivers, but mostly because I was like, the Bucks are winning a lot of games and their two best players are having really good years. Under Griffin, it looked like it was working. Those guys were playing really well together. Lillard was the starting guard in the East, and that's not just sentimental. It's because he was having he was a famous player having a really good year for a team that was one of the best, second best team in the conference at the time. So, you know, obviously Giannis going down at the most inopportune time. Lillard post All-Star break did not look as effective or as bouncy as he had in the first half. He's a 34-year-old guard who has played with the ball in his hands his whole career as a franchise player. So yeah, he's pretty tired. I can imagine. Yeah, I still believe. No, I mean, I don't believe because it's Rivers, but I believe in Lillard still mostly being the player that they thought they were acquiring, the player they thought was an upgrade over Jrue Holiday.
Who, of and, course, goes on to win a championship.
Right, so it makes it look extra bad, but I think that obscures it. I think, again, that's looking just at the last taste. Lillard, the point is Lillard was never brought in to be the number one guy. Yes, he should have the ball in his hands in tight fourth quarters, and that's what he was supposed to bring. That didn't pan out like that when it mattered, didn't get the chance to. But again, and like we've said in almost every one of these examples, health plays, you know, is kind of the X factor and the crucial ingredient in almost all of these situations. If you have Antetokounmpo, Lillard and Middleton mostly healthy, so Middleton is truly the number three option that bringing Dame on was supposed to put him at, especially with him above 30 and having several injuries, then no. I mean, they should be kind of looking at what they hoped was last year. You have those three guys healthy. You're really, you feel good running with those guys. I don't think Lillard is done. I 1,000,000% agree. This is the crucial year.
Amazing. Great note to end on. Sorry, unless you had one other thing, Shiraz. You're good. All right, that was a great one to end on. And it's nice to end on that note because I think, you know, just from your tone, we're both pretty intrigued about Damian Lillard and what's going to happen this year on that team. Pretty, pretty intrigued.
I'm not ready to write him off as over the hill yet.
Yeah, I'm not either, but that's what makes the year so fascinating is I think we're going to get an answer to that question. Well, Shiraz, man, thank you so much. I mean, we did our 5 and 5. People listening, I hope you enjoyed it. I know Arya is a favorite of some of y'all. Others, not so much. No, I'm just kidding. They are big fans. I want to apologize to the family of Mikal Bridges. And Miles Bridges, please, just remember, 500 feet away at all times. And we're going to take a quick break right now. We're going to come back, and I'm going to speak a little bit about Tyreek Hill and what went down in the Miami traffic stop to end all traffic stops. Once again, this is Edge of Sports Podcast brought to you by The Nation Magazine. We'll be back right after this quick word. We'll be back right after this, but first, a quick word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine. Okay, look, the need for independent journalism has never been more important, and The Nation brings it each and every week like they've been doing since 1865. I'm serious. This is what you gotta read. It's The Nation magazine. Go to thenation.com/subscribe. And please never forget that when you support The Nation magazine, you are also supporting the continued existence of this podcast. So please subscribe. Go to www.thenation.com/subscribe. And now, back to the Edge of Sports podcast. And now, I've got some choice words. Okay, look. Before last Sunday's game, the Miami-Dade police pulled over Dolphins all-pro wide receiver Tyreek Hill outside of his hometown stadium. From the video footage, it's clear the police put Hill face down on the concrete twice. One of the officers appears to have struck Hill while the NFL star was complying with orders. Because it was filmed, the media broadcast the incident within minutes. This news overtook the game day hype before the first Sunday of the season, surely a distressing fact for NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. After the game, one of Hill's teammates, the 38-year-old locker room leader Calais Campbell, said he tried to de-escalate the situation and that the police also cited and cuffed him. Now, Hill went on to play one of his typically brilliant games, but afterwards he looked shaken when recounting the experience to the press. He quietly asked the question, "What if I wasn't Tyreek Hill?" You might expect the NFL to stand up for one of its most famous players, but the NFL does not cross the police. The NFL partners with the police. Hell, the NFL is the police. This is a league that blackballed quarterback Colin Kaepernick for kneeling during the national anthem to protest racist police violence after the killings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile in 2016. It is also a league that, in the wake of outrage from all sides over how it handled Kaepernick's protest, turned to public relations instead of honest dialogue. It wanted to be seen as a force to end racism, words it emblazoned in the back of every end zone. It would play Lift Every Voice and Sing before the Star-Spangled Banner. Even Sunday's news that rapper Kendrick Lamar had been chosen to play the halftime show at the next Super Bowl is a part of this agenda. And if you're surprised the NFL would choose someone as political as Lamar, you might remember that the last time he played the Super Bowl halftime show, his lyrics about police killing civilians mysteriously disappeared. Notice what all these gestures allied. They refused to address what Kaepernick called upon the world to confront: racist police brutality and those in uniform getting away with murder. It immediately brought to mind last week's scandal when a right-wing propagandist allied with James O'Keefe surreptitiously videotaped Washington football team president Rael Antin. The O'Keefe media group is putrid, but it did catch Antin telling truths that people behind the shield are afraid to utter. About the league's anti-racist efforts, Antin said, "It's performative. It's not done out of the goodness of their hearts or morality. It's done because George Floyd changed the game. I mean that the social justice efforts are a performance for the sake of public perception and not because they actually push progress." O'Keefe's minion asked if this kind of branding was being done to assuage liberals. And Antin perceptively said, "No, I think it's to make as much money as possible. I think the NFL cares about the bottom line like any corporation above all else, and they don't need to really pinch pennies because they make so much revenue. Therefore, they can faux prioritize DEI for the sake of good publicity." The Washington Commanders fired Antin faster than a Tyreek Hill sprint to the end zone. Now, there were loud online voices that said that Hill should not receive sympathy because of his ugly past of spousal and child abuse. While awful, this is absurd. It is a logic that advances a reactionary line of thinking in which only a perfect victim deserves justice. The police did not know or care about Hill's past, and it wouldn't matter if they did. No one should be subject to state violence. In the current political climate, this incident matters. One presidential candidate is calling for mandatory stop and frisk by the nation's police and wants to grant police full immunity from charges of brutality. For these initiatives, despite his own criminality, he's been endorsed by the Fraternal Order of Police. The other party, when faced with an opportunity to remake and rethink policing in 2020 following the murder of George Floyd, instead insisted on more funding for the police. and we will hear nothing from their candidate about policing so as not to take any position that could offend the non-existent political middle. Forget the fact that every Cheney Democrat could probably fit in a phone booth. 8 years ago, amid a vacuum of leadership, NFL players started to build a movement using their cultural visibility to fight back against racist police violence. The league killed it and offered a series of empty gestures in its stead. The NFL is run by billionaire franchise owners who are mostly Trump supporters, many of whom are bankrolling Trump's promise of accountable policing. They are profiting off of black bodies on the field and criminalizing them off of it. If Hill and Campbell want to understand why the police saw their lives as something less than, they could start with the owner's box. The real estate developer Stephen M. Ross, the Dolphins owner and their boss, is a friend of and fundraiser for Trump. It all recalls the day in 2019 when mogul and rapper Jay-Z announced a partnership with the league. With Goodell sitting by his side, Jay-Z said, "We have moved past kneeling." Well, the NFL certainly has. And by the way, have you heard that Kendrick is playing the Super Bowl? Well, that's all we have for this week. Thank you so much to The Nation magazine. Thank you so much to Arya Shirazi. And thank you to David Tigaboo, the producer of this podcast. For everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.